Sunday with Miriam on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Travel Department. Explore the wonder of the world's most iconic sites with Travel Department, the world discovered together.
Well, for over 80 years, Dunn Stores has been at the heart of Irish life. From the first store on Patrick Street in Cork City, the Dunn family has grown the business to be the force it is now in Irish retail. But wealth hasn't shielded the family from infighting, from addiction and from controversy. Well, broadcaster and journalist Matt Cooper tells the story of the Dunn's family in a book called Dynasty, Scandals, Triumph, Turmoil and Succession at the heart of Dunn Stores. And Matt's here with me this morning. Morning to you, Matt.
Thank you very much, Miriam.
Listen, it's a fascinating read. First of all, because I'm always intrigued, let's start almost at today with Mrs. Heffernan. I've never met her, but like she seems an extraordinary, formidable woman who runs Dunn Stores.
She does, even though she's in her 80s. And her daughter and niece, Anne and Sharon, are very, very important in the business, but she remains the key pivotal figure. When Ben died in late 2023, I was contacted almost immediately by a publisher to ask, would I be interested in writing a book about Ben? And when I thought about it, I thought, actually, Ben is a fascinating character and he is very central to the book. But there are other people who are equally as interesting as him. And Margaret Heffernan is one of those people. Because Margaret Heffernan, how she has managed to take control of the business and change the business while keeping it all within family ownership is absolutely fascinating. And when I started thinking about how I would approach this book if I was going to do it, Ben's story was incredibly important, but then all of the other siblings as well. And there's an extraordinary interaction between them and how they fell out and tragically deaths of a number of, or two of them at a very early age. It was also the story of a business that has that takes about one in every 5 euro that we spend in the shops every week, which has become so important in the supermarket trade, but also in clothing people. And that's where it started out. It only got into food retailing about a decade after it had started with its clothes retailing. So there's an extraordinary business story there, which I've told in the book. There's also an incredible story about how Ireland has changed from the time that Dunn Stores was set up in 1944, when we had an awful lot of poverty at the time in Ireland, and people were so careful about how they would spend their money. And I'm not, there obviously are people at the moment who still struggle financially, but Ireland has changed so much in our consumer habits over the time, and it has changed so much in society as well and culturally, which their story also illustrates as you go through the family and the business story. So all of these things intermingled for me in the story. And then, of course, you also had great political intrigue, because you and I would both remember, because we would have worked in it at the time in the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, the tribunals, which were essentially caused as sort of a domino effect because of Ben Dunn's actions over a number of years, and most famously in Orlando back in 1992.
Go right back to the beginning to Ben Sr., and his wife, Nora, wasn't it? Was it in 1944 in Cork?
Yeah, this was actually, for me, was one of the most enjoyable parts of the book, was actually finding out more about them than I had expected to. Initially, when you're writing a book and you sort of set out almost a roadmap of what you expect to do, and I thought there might be a sort of a short section on the parents before I got directly into the siblings. But as I kept researching, I kept finding more and more things that I found more and more interesting. And so Ben Sr. became a major figure in the book himself, from coming from Ross Trevor in County Down, being under the influence of arguably the most important civil servant of the 20th century, Ken Whittaker, who used to bring him to school in the mornings when they were small children.
So random.
It is. And maintained this friendship and relationship throughout their life. And when Ben Dunn Sr. died, Ken Whittaker wrote a really number of really informed pieces in tribute to his friend, and there were other things from a biography of Ken Whittaker a number of years ago. Ken lived to a great age himself, many years after Ben Sr. But it was fascinating to see the story of Ben Sr.'s growing up and his father Barney, who, from what I could find out, there's an awful lot of similarities with the way Ben Jr. ended up, or Bernard, as the family would always call him. We always knew Ben Dunn, and you'd have interviewed him many times as Ben. Yeah. The family know him as Bernard. That's how he would be known. But, you know, he had resembled his own grandfather in so many ways, and his own grandfather had addiction issues as well. And this is something, of course, that ran through the family. But so I've managed to get a lot of detail about how the business developed in the early decades and up until the time of Ben Sr.'s death in 1983, and just the extraordinary gruffness. And it was terrific to be able to find a couple of people, even though he died over 40 years ago, who remembered him dealing with him. Yeah. So there would be a very established former banker, Jay Burke's father, John Burke. He met me and told me about meetings that he used to have with Ben when he was a young businessman with Ben Sr. The property developer, Johnny Ronan, actually used to have meetings with his own father, and himself used to go and meet with Ben Sr. in Dublin in the 1970s every Wednesday afternoon for drinks, first in the Shelburne Hotel, then after that in the Berkeley Court. So I was able to form a picture of Ben Sr. and the gruffness, but also what went on behind him. And he was an exceptionally diligent businessman. And in that period as well, one thing I discovered is we don't probably have enough books about the economic history of the time, that there is an awful lot written when you go through the history of Ireland over the last 100 years about the politics of partition and what happened with the IRA. And although there's great writings by the likes of John A. Murphy and John Lee, and Garvin, who died recently, there isn't probably enough about the whole thing about our, just how we spent our money. And that was one of the things that I was keen to actually get to the bottom of, about what we did with our disposable income over these decades.
He was such a visionary, though, Ben Sr. was. I mean, even Cornell's Court, my mother's mecca still. But like, I worked there as well when I was a student. But like, that was his vision, wasn't it, to have this huge out-of-town shopping centre?
Absolutely. And it was fascinating finding all the material from the time when Cornell's Court was set up. There were special buses used to be run from Dublin City Centre to bring people out to it. But I think, in fairness, Frank, their son, who died about 3 years ago, who at one stage was the heir apparent before Ben Jr. became the boss, but Frank had his own demons and difficulties, which I detail in the book. But Frank, I think, deserves an enormous amount of praise as well for the foresight in relation to setting up a Cornell's Court. And what's also interesting about Cornell's Court is how it has been redeveloped over the years. And it is, I had never been in it until I was writing this book, so I decided to go out and have a look at it. And I it lived up to what I had been told about it. But as it happens, there's possibly even a better Dunn Stores down in Cork, because the one on the Southern Ring Road, as you head out beyond Bishopstown, if you want to head out towards West Cork, various people in the trade internationally will say that this is possibly the finest supermarket you will find in Europe, and that it is extraordinarily profitable for them, and it brings people from all over Cork City to shop there and from West Cork coming in. It's an extraordinary place.
There's loads of great yarns, and I love the brine nylon shirts. Tell people about that. It's just so funny.
Okay, well, I suppose what they were brilliant at in the early days, before we try to get into the whole thing about the food and drink retailing, they clothed people in Ireland, and they did change the way in which clothes were actually sold, keeping the cost down, buying in bulk, and that they would then... Yes, you would go in, pick up what you wanted, and you went and bought it. Now, brine nylon shirts, I mean, you and I are not old enough to remember brine nylon shirts, okay? But I think they were marketed very much on the basis of being sort of, you didn't have to iron them, you sort of washed
them. I'm all for them.
And they were made out of a particular type of byproduct of chemicals and whatever. And this is what John Burke would have been involved in selling into to Dunn Stores as well. And but there was one famous incident as well in relation to a trade show in the United States.
With one Mr. Hoy.
Exactly, because Ben Sr. and Margaret were at this trade show in the United States, and Haughey was there opening. I think there was a trade delegation, or there was a various office for the state been opened, and he went to this particular exhibition, and he discovered that Ben Dunn was displaying brine nylon shirts. and he flipped, and he was absolutely, of course, we discovered afterwards from the tribunals, which Ben Jr. was responsible for, that how he used to get his handmade shirts from Charvet in Paris. But he thought this was an absolute disgrace, and he said, "Do you think you're in the effing Ivy flea market?" And demanded that the shirts be removed and the display been taken down. And it led to quite poor relations between the Dunn family and Haughey afterwards, down to a fascinating story about how Margaret wanted to know at the time of her father's funeral if Charles Haughey, as leader of the opposition, had actually been there, because she hadn't seen his name signed in the book of offering condolences. And he said he had been there, but he had to leave early to go to another meeting.
Wow, it's amazing how it all came back round again with Ben Jr. He did, and I think his interviews you conducted with Ben Dunn Jr., they're almost central to this fascinating book. Why do you think, like, Margaret Heffernan never does interviews? We've all tried, right? But why do you think he saw publicity whilst his brothers and sisters avoided it?
It was his personality, his temperament. He loved being an entertainer to an extent. He loved the company of journalists. He was remarkable in that on the occasions that I would have been out in his house or when I would have met him elsewhere, he would tell you everything. He just almost couldn't stop. He was so open, and he would tell you things that would let your jaw would be dropping at some of the stuff that he actually told you, some of which I've been able to use for the book, some of which still I can't use at this stage. He just loved the company of people, I think. And I think he loved gossip. So he loved journalists because journalists liked gossip. So he wanted to hear stories from you as well when he was telling you stories. But then again, he also had a reason for telling you a lot of things because there was an agenda at work there. But even after he, and this is central part to Dynasty as well, that even after he got in all the trouble at the tribunals, he used to love talking to you or to Joe Duffy or to various people. And Joe told me a fascinating thing as well, which I was fascinated by, was that Joe and Ben used to swap books in cemeteries. They were both developed an interest in cemeteries. Now, Joe, of course, has written his books about the children of the 1916 Rising and very interested in all of that. But as I put it to Joe, I said, that's really interesting about Ben, because I think the central event in his life, everyone talks about Orlando, and yes, Orlando was an absolutely seminal moment, but it was the kidnapping. And I go into the kidnapping in quite a lot of detail because Ben told me a lot about the kidnapping. Mm. And he, at one stage, when he was being released, he was released at a graveyard. And there was an open grave that had been dug for somebody to be buried in the following day. This is in Collyhanna in the north. Mm. And he jumped into it for fear that somebody would come along and mistake him for somebody else and shoot him. God. And when he was in the grave, he then suddenly got the fear that he was going to be, that he would literally be buried alive in there, that somebody would come along and start throwing in the earth on top of him. So he scrambled out of the grave.
So traumatic.
Utterly traumatic. Yeah. And he was absolutely, Ben's life after that was dictated by the trauma that he had experienced. So much so, I mean, he told me one day, and there was a famous time when he was appearing at me at events in a wheelchair and then on crutches because he'd broken both of his ankles. Mm. And he told me what had happened. That he had given a story up publicly that he had an accident in the swimming pool. There's a swimming pool in the house that he lived in for many years, which is, by the way, now about to be demolished to be turned into apartments. But he said that he had jumped in the shallow end and had broken his ankles. The reality, as he told me, was that he had been using cocaine again. And this is post Orlando. He got flashbacks. And when his security came to try and look after him, he thought they were IRA gunmen coming to kidnap him. And he ran. And he ran through the garden and he managed to clamber up on the 12-foot high wall outside the house. And he jumped off it. And on the jump coming down the other side, that's how he broke his ankles. But it was a clear sign that, you know, he still was completely tormented by what had actually happened to him.
Yeah, you write brilliantly about all of the siblings, certainly in relation to addiction for some of them. And also about how Margaret Heffernan, did she become close in the end after all Ben Jr. had been through? Did they reconcile?
Yes, and I think it's to her great credit from what I understand. Mm. And again, I mean, I make it quite clear, I have not had cooperation from Margaret or anyone close to her in relation to this book. But I did from various people learn that, she was very generous towards Ben. I think she felt that she had already lost her sisters, two of her sisters who died. She was determined to try and keep the family together where possible. So she would have talked to him regularly about what was going on in the business without giving him any belief that he could return to the business, because famously there was an enormous bust-up in the 1990s when he was removed as executive chairman. Then he was bought out of the business, and it's all explained how it was done in the book. But she then, you know, they wouldn't have been close as in seeing each other every day like that, but they would have kept in regular contact, and she would have let him know what was going on. And it made him feel, I think, to a degree involved, because in reality, I think, outside of Dunn Stores, he wasn't a particularly successful businessman. Yes, he had a small chain of gyms and whatever, and he made various investments. But as I detail in the book, he had lots of really good ideas, but he wasn't brilliant at following through them, because once he was outside of that cocoon almost that was Dunn Stores.
Why have they been so successful? I mean, you do give lots of examples of the family's great generosity in it, but is there also a ruthlessness? I mean, how come Dunn Stores is so successful?
Utterly ruthless. Ruthless at times in relation to its treatment of workers, which I detail in the book, although trade union officials do tell me at the moment they regard Dunn Stores at this stage of its existence as being a model employer in the retail sector. But there were many times throughout the years when it wasn't. And in particular, I would go into the details of what happened in relation to the apartheid strike in Henry Street in the mid-1980s. They've been ruthless in relation to the treatment of suppliers in things that they do in property, would go to the courts on a regular basis. I suppose it's always a question of the ends justifies the means for Margaret. And I think Margaret Heffernan has been obsessed with the idea of legacy and with keeping the family name over the door, which is Dunn Stores, and she married into the Heffernan family. And she has just been utterly determined, even into her 80s now. As I said, her daughter Anne, her niece Sharon are centrally involved in the running with the of the business and would have had influence on much of the change that's going on. But nothing happens unless Margaret wants it to happen.
She also, I even know privately from, you know, special needs, additional needs charities, she's really generous, quietly in the background, isn't she?
Absolutely. And she going back to the time involved in setting up People in Need back in the 1980s, and you know, but apart from that, a lot of generosity as well towards former staff who might have fallen in hard times. There would have been very privately, I know, funerals that would have been paid for members of staff who had served loyally over the years. At the same time, you have to say that there is an extraordinary amount of wealth there. These are amongst the richest people in Ireland as well. So you would want them to be generous, I suppose, given the extreme wealth that they have built on the back of selling to the Irish people.
It's a great read, Matt. Matt Cooper, thanks so much for telling the story of such a fascinating family. The book is called Dynasty, as we said, Scandals, Triumph, Turmoil and Succession at the Heart of Dunn Stores. It's fantastic. Thanks so much for being my
Thank
guest
you very
today.
Much.